It is Friday, February the 10th. This is the Christian Commute. You're riding home with your host, Seth Dunn. Thank you for joining me on this sad, sad program without theme music. I don't know if any of you miss my theme music, but it sure makes my program quicker to upload on the computer. So I'm not using it right now. I sound less professional. But that's okay, because this isn't a professional podcast anyway. I am getting sick. My wife told me that I should go to the doctor today, but I was busy at work, and I didn't want the doctor to charge me $25 to tell me that I had a cold and to wait 3 days and I'd be better. I can do that myself and save $25. Plus, I've pretty much gotten dinged for a copay from everyone in my family. The baby got born. That wasn't a copay. That was just a zillion dollars. My wife went to the doctor yesterday. My other three kids have been to the doctor. Do I really need to go to the doctor to be told what I have? I'm pretty sure I know what I have. So, that's it. And I'm going to power through the Christian Commute anyway with what little health that I have left because I love my show. Today's show topic is going to be called Full-Time Pastors, Part-Time Authors. That is full-time pastors, part-time authors. But before we get to that, we're going to continue our review of 1 Corinthians chapter 14. We are in verses 6 through 12 today. Verses 6 through 12. And this is a frank assessment of tongues from the Apostle Paul. This is continuing from the point that he was making yesterday, which we reviewed in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verses 1 through 5. We're in verses 6 through 12. Speaking in tongues is of no profit without revelation or prophecy or teaching. These things edify the church. Somebody didn't know something before, and then they know it because they have been taught. It's been revealed to them. It's been prophesied to them. They can take an action off of it. Music with no notes is noise. Exactly. So tongues that people can't understand. When somebody's in church, they're speaking in tongues, and no one understands them because there's no interpreter. Those kinds of tongues are like music with no notes. That's actually a bad way to put that, because music inherently has notes. It's like the sound of an instrument. Paul uses flutes and harps, I think, is his example. If somebody who doesn't know how to play the flute just picks it up and blows it, it's like wee, 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 wee. Or somebody who doesn't know how to play the harp just grabs a harp and starts scratching at the strings, and it's like boom, 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 boom. That's not music. That's noise. And someone who's a musician who picks up a musical instrument and knows how it works, they play a song. Well, they play different notes. And Paul makes an argument that even music has an intelligibility to it with the different tones and the different notes. But uninterpreted tongues are like somebody picking up an instrument and just making noise. It's unintelligible. So uninterpreted tongues is just like a baby playing the flute. How about that? And Paul gives another very good analogy about the bugle. He says, you know, the bugle makes the call to battle. You know, wait, that means if you're on the army base and they play the bugle, that means wake up, right? And there's another bugle call to call someone to battle. This was true even in Paul's day. So there would be somebody in the armed forces or in the army, and when it was time to attack, they played a specific note on the bugle. And everybody in that army knew when they heard that sound from the horn, it was time to charge forth. But it had to be that sound from the bugle. It had to be the battle call. So when we're Christians, and you know, in a sense we're in spiritual battle against the powers and principalities, and we have to put on the full armor of God and have the sword of the Spirit, etc., etc. If we're the church and we're going to be exhorted to battle, we need to hear the right notes, the right prophecy, the revelation, the teaching, what we can understand. And in the same way, an army needs to hear that call from the bugle, that specific sound that means attack. Otherwise, it's just what? A bunch of noise that doesn't mean anything to anybody. Every language has meaning. You know, Paul says there's many different kind of languages in the world, and they all have meaning. And you got to understand that Paul is a Hellenist. All right, so he's from the Greek culture. Now, let me give you another short history lesson. Sometime after, I guess, Cyrus's Persian dynasty, Alexander the Great, the Greek, basically took over the known world in Europe. And when he did, he instituted a policy of Hellenization. So when he conquered Persia, he replaced the Persian gods with their pantheon of gods with the Greek pantheon of gods and the Greek language. He conquered through military might, and then his strategy for holding on to power, although he didn't hold on to it very long because he died at a young age, not from battle, just from illness. His blood didn't clot well. He was a free bleeder. He actually died during a drunken orgy. But Alexander thought, I can hold my empire together not only if I conquer them militarily, but if I conquer them culturally. So when he conquered an area, he replaced their gods with Greek gods. It was basically the same gods by different names. Oh, this is your head god. Well, now this is Zeus. Who's his wife? Well, whatever her name is, now her name is Hera. And they replaced the religion, and they replaced their language with the Greek language. And this works very well for paganism, because pagans are lost idolaters, and they're polygamists to begin with. It didn't work so well under Judaism. That's why you had the Maccabean Revolt in the intertestamental period, because one of Alexander's successors, there were various successor states. After Alexander died, his generals took portions of his empire. And Antiochus Epiphanes was one of these successors in the part of the empire that where the Holy Land was, where Israel was. And Israel, being the monotheistic people that they were, you know, they held on to their gods, and they didn't take to paganism very well. And that was basically one of the reasons for the Maccabean Revolt. But everybody else took to Hellenism. And even the Jews, who didn't give up their belief in Yahweh, they took to Hellenism in different ways. That's why we have all these Jewish people writing the New Testament in Greek. So we have Paul, who comes from a Hellenistic culture. He's Jewish, but yet he's Hellenistic. He's a Jew and a Greek, so to speak. And he was very useful as the disciple to the Gentiles, or the apostle to the Gentiles, if you will. So here you have Paul steeped in Hellenistic culture, and now he's about to make a contrast or a comparison to barbarians. And he says, if I come to you speaking in tongues that you don't understand, I sound like a barbarian. And if you come to me speaking in tongues that I don't understand with no interpretation, well, then you sound like a barbarian to me. Now, it's not that barbarians didn't have intelligible languages. They did. Paul just sort of made that point. But what he's saying is, to a refined Hellenist, something other than Greek or maybe Aramaic or some other known language of cultured people is just going to sound barbarous. They're going to sound like forest people, you know, like these wild Germanic tribes who would later cause so many problems for the Roman Empire. They're going to sound like that, just these seemingly uncultured people with languages no one understands. So here's what Paul compares uninterpreted tongues to. And I want you to understand this. I want to make this clear. He compares it to barbarism. Not necessarily barbarism in a violent way, not their system of government, not their pagan religion, not how they kill people or worship trees or whatever they do. But their language.
tongues.
The language of uninterpreted tongues is like barbaric language. No cultured or refined person understands it, and it's being spoken by barbarians. What value could it have? Now, obviously, legitimate Holy Spirit-inspired tongues come from God, so there is value there. But Paul makes a big point about how important it is to have tongues interpreted. Elsewhere, it's just you're speaking barbarically. So if you seek the edification of the church, you will not speak in tongues if there is no one there to interpret. And I have been in a church service where someone spoke in tongues and they were not interpreted. It was not to anyone's edification. Quite frankly, it was just weird. And in this same service, a couple of young girls got slain in the spirit. And you see the preacher there doing that, or I did, and he actually later gave a pretty good sermon. But that guy's got no pastoral street cred with me. He grabs young women by the head and says, and throws them down. And then he has some parishioner over here going, that's literally what the guy said. Like, this is ridiculous. This is church. This is completely out of order. That was in Liberty Square in Cartersville, Georgia. It's the Church of God Church. So we'll end our Bible chapter review right there. And Lord willing, next time I will take 1 Corinthians 14 back up. I have a question in the inbox, a listener submission from Connie in Texas, but it's she wants me to review a sermon. I really can't do that so much on the Christian commute. I could listen to it sometime if I found the time and then comment, but it's rare for me to be able to do a good sermon review. So Connie, if you can listen to the sermon and tell me what sticks out about it to you is not quite right or not quite biblical, let me know. But for the listeners to understand, here's the context. Connie has a friend who's in this abortion ministry. And the ministry reaches out to women who feel guilt over having an abortion. And I don't know if they're trying to evangelize them or whatever. You should feel guilty if you had an abortion. You've murdered someone, your own child. But Connie is just not into this ministry her friend has. It's got too many red flags. It's very ecumenical. If my memory serves, they're okay with Catholics and stuff like that. But Connie's friend just doesn't get it. Does anybody have a friend like that? They're in a ministry and they think it's so great and they want you to be in it too, but you're like, not exactly. I don't think that ministry is all it's cracked up to be. And these people are like the people who are in CrossFit. You got to come to CrossFit with me. It's so great. I don't want to go to CrossFit. Just because you go every day and you really like it doesn't mean I will. Don't let your ministry be CrossFit, especially if it... And get what I'm saying. Your hobby or something that you just really like that's not necessarily a calling of God, especially if it's some parachurch thing. Remember, ministry starts at your local church. First, see if you can find something to do through your local church. And that's a good test. If you're a member of a local church and you say, hey, pastor, hey, board of elders or whoever, I would like to participate in this ministry over here, and I would like our church to be a part of it. Maybe we can give it some money. Maybe we could advertise it in the church bulletin. Then, if you do that, that's going to trigger some kind of accountability, because most pastors aren't going to say, yeah, let's do it, and just send some money or put it in the bulletin. They're going to say, well, let me look into it first. Let me see if it's sound. Let me think if it's solid. So if the elders at your church are looking into the ministry, now this is presuming you go to a sound church, they might come back and say, no, this is no good. So whenever somebody wants you to participate in a ministry with them, a parachurch ministry, whether it be some kind of abortion support group like Connie's friend is in, or even a food pantry or anything else, always ask, well, does your church sanction it? Yes or no? And if the answer is no, well, you already have somebody who's kind of off the reservation. It's not that you're not allowed to do ministry things without quote-unquote permission from your church. It's just smart. And I'll give you an example. At my old church, there was a woman who came there. Her name was Linda. And She was in and out. I don't think she went there very long. But she wanted our church to participate in some kind of ministry to ex-porn stars. And I don't know the name of the website, and if I did, I wouldn't recommend you go there. This woman who's an ex-porn star has supposedly gotten saved, and she reaches out to ex-porn stars, or to porn stars, who are not ex-porn stars, but porn stars, to try to get them out of that business, which is an inherently sinful business. But, I mean, there's a lot of inherently sinful businesses. So, selling cigarettes, one might argue, is an inherently sinful business. But it doesn't kill you if you don't smoke. But people in the pornography industry, they're exposed to sexually transmitted diseases. They basically devalue themselves by sinning over and over and over. I don't think anybody wants their kid to be a pornographic actress or actor when they grow up, right? So she has experience in this industry, so she has an in. She's trying to reach out to these people to evangelize them and get them out. So my pastor says, you know, Linda has suggested this ministry. Seth, will you look into it and see if it's something that the church should do? So I said, yeah, I'll look that up. So I looked it up, and this woman is standing outside of her house in a video with a staff, pointing to like different directions and saying, I claim the north for the Lord. I claim the south. I'm like Elijah. And I looked it up, and she was ordained by some, you know, weird fellowship who'll just ordain anybody. And I'm like, no, this lady is kooky. Plus, I mean, the website's kind of racy. Like, if you look, this is Bambi. She came out of porn. Here's Bambi's story. And it'd be like some salacious story. So I'm like, you know what? No, this doesn't seem up to snuff. Our church should not be involved with it. So I reported that back to the pastor. And he said, you know, Linda, you know, we're not going to do this. Here's the reasons. You know, I had Seth look into it, and I don't think it's something we need to do. So, presenting your parachurch ministry to your pastor is a good idea. You probably wouldn't want to participate in a ministry that your church wouldn't want to participate in, right? If your church says, oh no, that's those people treat Catholics like Christians and they're not brothers, you know, it could be anything, but they've got mainliners with them. They're saying you don't need Jesus to go to heaven. We don't want to have anything to do with that. You know, we don't want to send people to hell with a full belly. So, Connie, I know that's not your question, but maybe that's an approach you can have with your friend. Think of it like this. She sent you a sermon from some other pastor. Was it a sermon from her pastor? I mean, I don't know if it is or not, but that's... what does her church think of it? And then what do you think of her church? Because, you know, error, and it all starts with the local church, just like ministry does. If you have somebody from an undiscerning church where the elders are like, you know, just participate whenever you want to. Don't even tell us. We don't care. You know, anything goes. Well, they're probably unhealthy with which to begin. Where do you find sick people? You know, at the leper colony, right? Lepers live at the leper colony. So if somebody is unclean in their theology, as it were, maybe their church is a leper colony. Church shouldn't be a leper colony. Church should be full of clean people who've been healed, right? All right, so Connie, I know that's not what you asked, but that's my response. I hope it's helpful to you, helpful to the listenership. Now let's talk about today's show topic, which is full-time pastors, part-time authors. Who has ever read a book, or even if you haven't read one, seen a book by a prominent pastor in a Christian bookstore or something like that? Whether it be, you know, Mark Driscoll used to have a lot of books, Jim Cimbala has books, I think Johnny Hunt just came out with a book. You can think of famous pastors you know, and a lot of them have books, especially mega pastors. And I want to differentiate between types of books too. Let's say it's a famous pastor and he comes out with a Bible commentary, and a very academic Bible commentary. Well, that's something he could make during his work time while he's researching sermons, right? Because a good part of a pastor's time is spent looking at the Bible, studying the scripture, studying biblical commentary so he can form his sermon. Yes, he's going to manage things at the church. Yes, he's going to visit people, do counseling, etc., etc. You know, Mary and Barry, do those types of things. But he's also going to be doing theological things, even scholarly things. So I really put a pastoral commentary in a different category than a book about, you know, how to live your best life now, for example. Or 10 things that are holding you back in your walk with God. And I want you to just consider yourself, right? How many hours do you work a week? 40, 50, you know, 35? Most people work between 35 and 45 hours a week. If you're a professional, you probably work more than 40 hours a week. I work more than 40 hours a week. Sometimes I'll work 50, or sometimes I'll work 40. But so I work 40 hours a week. But let's do this by a day, right? Let's do this by a weekday. I work 8 hours a day, 8 to 9 hours a day, right? And then sometimes I've got, you know, 30 minutes for lunch, and I got to drive to work. That takes, you know, an hour. So work-related things like driving to work, eating while I'm at work, and working, now that's taken 8 hours of my day, or 10 hours of my day. And then I want to sleep for 8 hours, maybe seven. Let's say I sleep for 7 hours. So now I'm up to 17 hours. There's 24 hours in the day, and I've got 7 hours left that I'm going to eat dinner and eat breakfast and spend time with my family, because I have a full-time job. My job is quote-unquote full-time. When do I have time to write a book? I have extra time. I use it to do my seminary work, but it's not very much. And you're probably the same way. I'm sure you have hobbies. So add up your hobbies, your family time, your work time. What time do you have left over to write a book, much less a good one? And by the way, if you're a CEO, you're not working 40 hours a week. You're working 50 or 55. And a lot of these modern megachurch pastors kind of see themselves as a CEO. They've got a lot of people who work for them. They're preaching to thousands, so they spend a lot of time researching their sermon. They spend a lot of time managing their big organization. They're full-time pastors. Johnny Hunt says he works 60 hours a week. I've heard him say that before. Or somebody said that about him from a reliable source. I don't remember where that came from. It's probably a good estimate. He travels a lot, too. So a lot of these guys, like your Mark Driscolls of the world, your Jim Cymbalas of the world, your Johnny Hunt, Steve Gaines, you know, name a mega pastor. They have a busy travel and speaking schedule, and they seem to be writing books. Now, since they're prominent, people want to buy their books. If you're some bivocational pastor who works 30 hours a week, and that's your only... Don't even be bivocational. Let's just say you're a small church pastor who works 30 hours a week, and then maybe you're a farmer on the side or something like that. And in the non-growing season, you have a lot of free time. You actually have time to write a book. Who's going to read your book? No one's ever heard of you. But if you're a denominational megastar like J.D. Greer or Steve Gaines or Johnny Hunt, everybody in your denomination is going to, oh, look at that guy. Wow, I want to read his book. It's at my denominational bookstore. It's at LifeWay. It's great. Okay, so they know who you are, so they want to buy your book. So for those people who have time to write a book, who are pastors, nobody knows who they are. They don't want to buy their books. For those people who don't have time to write a book, everybody who knows who they, I mean, they don't have time to write a book and people want their book, how do they get it done? Well, ghostwriters, a lot of time. I've heard the story of Jim Cymbalas' ghostwriter before. So you'll have a big-name pastor like a Mark Driscoll or a David Jeremiah, and they'll write a book, and it may or may not be ghostwritten. And they spend time that they're, you know, quote-unquote, on the clock at their church writing this book, right? Now, sometimes pastors do this, and they donate the proceeds of their church or their book to their church. Sometimes they don't. But just realistically speaking, nobody can be a full-time pastor and a full-time author. And it's really hard to be a full-time pastor, period, and a part-time author. So who is writing all of these books by famous megapastors? Well, common sense says they have a lot of help from ghost writers and staff people. You have somebody like, you know, Peter Lumpkins is a kind of a lackey, for lack of a better term, for Jerry Vines. He used to do some writing for Jerry Vines. So somebody else is doing this. So you're really paying for somebody else's name, but not getting their work. You know, they've read it and edited it, perhaps, and they've contributed some ideas. So you're paying for that. You're kind of getting ripped off. And by the way, I personally would not want a book by a megapastor. Everything that I read by a megapastor is terrible. I read John Pisano's Pastor's Handbook. It made me want to puke. It literally made me nauseous. All right, I don't want anything. Forget you, megapastor. I don't want your book 99 out of 100 times. There are exceptions. But the people who are buying this book who think megapastors are great, oh, wow, I've got Real Marriage by Mark Driscoll. Oh, look, Mark Driscoll just happened to have a sermon series called Real Marriage at his church. Oh, look, his book's for sale out front. Do you see how it works? These mega churches find a way to monetize everything. They monetize their prominence. Somebody help me write a book. I'm a megapastor. Okay, now I'm going to preach a sermon series on it and sell the book out front of my church. Well, who's going to get the book money? The church or you? Sometimes them, sometimes the church. So somebody is kind of ripping you off by selling you a book that is supposedly by them, but it's not really by them. It's by their ghostwriter, so that's kind of a ripoff. It doesn't rip off me because I don't want their stupid book. And then they're ripping their church off because they're not spending 45 or 50 hours a week managing their church, ministering to their flock. Maybe they're spending 30 hours and they're doing 20 hours a week authoring their book. And don't think they don't have revenue streams. Man, you think of a big conglomerate corporation. Think of somebody like GE, General Electric. They have a revenue stream from household appliances, microwaves, and refrigerators. And then they have a revenue stream from airplane parts. And they have a revenue stream from the medical industries, making MRI machines. An MRI machine costs $800,000, by the way. Then they have revenue streams from finance, where they have GE Finance loaning things out. So if you think of a big company, they're diversified. They just don't have one revenue stream. That's why it's safe to invest in big companies. Like, if you're an investor in Kodak, well, too bad for you when film went out of fashion and people started liking digital cameras. That's when Kodak went under because they weren't diversified. They were a camera and film company, and they didn't have a good foot in the digital camera market. So bye-bye Kodak, right? But if you're invested in GE, if the airplane market tanks, well, there goes the airplane market part of the business. But hey, we're doing pretty well in medical supplies, right? These megapastors and their megachurches are the same way. They have different revenue streams. You think they're in the God business, right? And I hate to say the God business, and they kind of are, but they're in the speaking business. They go preach somewhere. They get paid to preach at their church. Then they get paid to go preach at conferences and denominational events. Their church may license their sermons over satellite, so they get paid for that. So they're in the speaking business. Then they're in the pastoring business, where they actually manage their church, and they might even take care of one of their sheep. Or, you know, manage somebody who manages somebody who takes care of a sheep, right? And then they're in the publishing business. They're in the book writing business. So they're speakers and writers and quote-unquote leaders. They're in the leadership business, the publishing business, and the speaking business. It's different revenue streams. So if their church goes out of business, if David Jeremiah's church went out of business for some reason, if, you know, Shadow Mountain burnt down, or, you know, everybody just left, I don't know why, he would still be a prominent author. So keep that in mind the next time you go shopping at the Christian bookstore. And by the way, never go shopping at the Christian bookstore. But keep that in mind the next time you want to buy a book from some prominent pastor. Did he shirk some bit of pastoral responsibility to write this book? I don't care who you are. You only have 24 hours in a day. There's only one incident that I know of when God made a day longer for somebody. Remember in Joshua, I think it's Joshua chapter 10, when Joshua holds his staff up and, you know, he didn't hold his staff up. He prays for the sun to stand still, and it does, and the day is long enough for the Israelites to win the day. Yeah, your modern megapastor doesn't have more hours than you do. He just has more help and a big name. So be wary of full-time pastors and part-time authors. They're probably not doing a good job at either endeavor. No catechism today because I'm in the other car. Thanks for listening to the Christian Commute, and God bless.